No food today. That's the only difference, apparently. But they have a convention of the little people in the other part of the hotel, and I did not know that until I got here, and someone motioned me into the other door. So we will wish them well. Wanted to tell you that I just signed 5 more church charters, and the churches are chartering as they can, and I have them here for Mrs. Glenda Brazil, my secretary, and we are still working on the overflow feast sites near Branson, Missouri, and or out in Lake Tahoe, or possibly even up in Vancouver, or near there in British Columbia. It could be this year that we're going to have at least 1 Canadian, if not 2 Canadian feast sites. We've already nailed down, we know we're going to have Panama City Beach. And I've heard some very good things from some of the ministry. Mr. Tom Carey down in New Orleans says that representing some of the people there and that he's talked to around Hattiesburg and elsewhere, he knows of at least 150 that want to come there. I just talked to Bruce Chapman this morning, who is the area coordinator up in Michigan, and they had something like 60-some for the Passover and up into the 80s for the first and the second days of unleavened bread. And that was very nice to hear. So there's some pretty good numbers out there of some of the church groups that are meeting. We don't know yet if we're going to be able to have a West Coast feast site around, for example, in Lake Tahoe. I'm just not certain. But when we find out, we will let you know. That door, someone vandalized the building, apparently, and there's a shattered piece of glass there, and the wind was just blowing in there. And the minute you open it, the wind takes it out of your hands and slams it shut. I'm a little shaken right now, and my stomach was churning because on the way here, there was a horrible accident down just on the mile and a half south of the loop. A little red car apparently hit just head-on another vehicle. Looked to me like no one could have survived that. And there was already a fire truck there, but no ambulances yet. And it was just very disturbing to see that. You look, I hope that's not anyone I know, but, you know, it would make it all the worse. But still, it's someone that lots of people know and love, and that's always a horrible thing to see happen. If you were to get into an airplane and go to the holiest place that you know, where would you want to go? If you wanted to go to a holy place today. Of course, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Muslims just finished with their Hajj, which is their word for a pilgrimage, to go to Mecca. And there, if you saw on CNN, they went around and around and around the Kaaba. Now, the Kaaba is a very large, square-shaped black building. It houses a so-called sacred stone. And that stone has been there since way back in the earliest years after the time of Christ, and probably even before. Remember that the Islamic religion didn't really begin until 600 years this side of Christ, and didn't really get going in the Middle East and begin to spread into Syria and other countries until the 8th century. It is a comparatively new religion, therefore. Prior to that time, the religion there was utterly pagan. And after the Hajira, which was the original Hajj of the escape from Mecca to Medina on the part of Muhammad the Prophet, he then, when the Yathrib, which was the name before the time it was changed to Medina, and the group of tribal chieftains who were with him went back down to Mecca and attacked it, he went into the city and destroyed about 126 different gods and idols. But the one that he did retain was that black rock. And he had a kind of a hodgepodge mixture of Judeo-Christian and other self-made religion that he began to impose upon the people that he called his followers or his helpers. And little by little, that religion grew until now. Of course, it encompasses approximately about 1 billion human beings all over the earth. So here they were. I would like to ask some of them a question, but I can't. I'd get myself killed because, you know, as a Christian, if I were to try to go to Mecca and go inside that so-called holy city, it would cost me my life. Western Christians have gotten in there, but only by professing Islam, and only by going to an imam and saying that there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. And I would never say the latter part of that. Of course, Allah is merely their way of saying El or Eloah or Elohim, but I would certainly never say Muhammad was his prophet because I know better by looking into the life of Muhammad. But now, if I were a Muslim and I were going around and I lost track, would I really be in terrible trouble with this God that I'm supposed to be worshiping if I only went around the Kaaba 6.5 times? You've got to go around 7 times. What if I went 14 times? I'd be double holy, wouldn't I? I'd be twice as holy as the rest of them, wouldn't I? Recently, when the Pope was in Cuba, of course, they were selling the usual trinkets and the veils and the shawls and the crucifixes and the rosaries, the little pictures and all the various things that they sell for the Catholics. And as the Pope mobile goes by, the people hold up those objects and the Pope does this. You know, he makes funny signs. He could just go zot, you know, if he wanted to. He could say zot, zot, or zot like that. And that would be, I think, far more effective, don't you? Of flipping the holy or whatever toward them than it would be just to make funny signs like that with his hand. And you notice the way he holds his fingers. His hands tremble a lot now. And so then when people take these things home, they put it in a separate little niche in the corner, or they hang it on the wall, and forever after to all their relatives and everybody else, they can say, this was blessed by the Pope. Do you believe that any human being on the face of this earth has the power to make a funny sign in the air and that some magical sort of power or energy or force or something attaches itself to your watch or your medallion or your shawl or your beads or your crucifix, and thereafter it always is holy? Of course, there are Protestant evangelicals who have gotten away with selling crosses that glow in the dark. Now, if you think this isn't an issue, you ought to see some of the mail that I've received over the many decades, and you ought to have gone into some of the ministerial meetings that I've attended over many, many years with regard to holy places and holy times, and to see the arguments that people can get into over when to keep Pentecost, whether 5 and 6 or counting it the way we do from the time of the wave sheaf offering on the Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread. 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. Unto the morrow after the 7th Sabbath shall you count unto you 7 Sabbaths, and that shall be the feast of Pentecost. They argue about the calendar, about where the festival ought to be observed. Years ago, I got a letter from a man who was fairly highly placed in the church at that time who said we had no business observing the Feast of Tabernacles in Jekyll Island, Big Sandy, and Squaw Valley. We ought to be going to Jerusalem. That's where the feast ought to be held. I thought, now, if you could make that go down with our people, you know how many people would be there? That guy, if he had the money, and nobody else. And he would attend the feast all by himself. Is Jerusalem truly, and I love the song, I've sung it many times, the holy city? It's called that. And people that are supposed to be nominal Christians make their pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and especially at Christmas time. But Easter and Christmas, the two great pagan festivals, Ishtar and, of course, the winter solstice of the sun, which is dedicated to Solus Invictus, this is the time when people go there because they believe it is holy. Would you be holier if you were to go to Jerusalem and to observe one of the annual festivals of God there as opposed to here? Now, if there is a holy place, what is it that makes it holy? Is there something inside the place? And is it holy from the, get this is very important, the exterior of the wall or from the interior of the wall? Is it holy from the grounds that encompass it with maybe a gate or a fence around it, or is it only holy from inside the walls? Is it holy only from the floor to the ceiling, or is it holy beneath? You think I'm just making something up here? No, this is very important, because what if you went to this place, if you were a believing Christian or a Muslim, and there was a big crowd, and you could only get half inside. So you're standing with 1 foot outside and 1 foot inside. Are you half holy? People wrestle with these concepts about holy places and holy things. Let's turn to Exodus, the 3rd chapter. Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. He led the flock to the backside of the desert to come to the mountain of God. The backside of the desert would have been the westernmost part and therefore the most fertile part. And isn't it interesting that the first time you encounter the word desert in the Bible is feeding a flock? So the usage of the biblical term for desert is not the very same as you think of an utterly desolate place with nothing but creosote bushes and greasewood and not a blade of grass in sight. There was herbage, foliage, there was fodder for the animals. and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. Now, Moses is allegedly the author of the first five books of the Bible, but scholarship reveals that Ezra very likely did edit and wrote portions of the first five books of the Bible later on. For example, in the last chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, it talks about the death of Moses and where he was buried, and obviously Moses didn't write that. So the mountain of God, they have always taken to mean, was a mystical concept in the mind of the priest of Midian, and that they called it the mountain of God, and that Moses kind of knew it was the mountain of God. I doubt that. Otherwise, what was he doing there with his flocks when he saw this phenomenon of a burning bush? The angel of the Eternal appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. That's logical. That's what anybody would want to know. How is it that the bush is not burnt? And when the Eternal saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. He said, Draw not nigh hither. Put off your shoes from off your feet, for the place whereon you stand is holy ground. If you look up the word holy, it has to do with sanctification, with demarcation, with separation, with a special place. Now, if you could go to the mountain of Horeb, and it's known fairly closely where that is, although there is a great deal of argument about where Sinai really was, and some people are claiming it's all the way up in Turkey. Others think it is clear up in northern Iraq and Kurdistan or somewhere near the Pamir Knot. Other people think it's in Saudi Arabia, and other people think it's where it really is, which is down in Sinai. But there's a lot of argument about it. If you could go there and find this very place today, would it be holy still today? I don't believe so myself. I think to answer that question for you, no. It had to do with the presence of God. It had to do with who was there. It probably wasn't holy the day before God came there and stood and caused this phenomenon of fire, which, by the way, the Holy Spirit is likened unto fire many times in the Bible. And as you know, on the day of Pentecost, it was fiery flames that came down and settled upon the heads of the apostles, did not even singe their hair, and was a real attention getter for the people in the crowd. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Notice, five times in one verse, the name God is mentioned. He starts with the God of Moses' own father, and then the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. God then told him he had seen the affliction of the people in Israel. Moses argued, Who am I, verse 11, that I should go unto Pharaoh, that I should bring forth the children of Israel? And, of course, then he gave him the token of the rod that turned into a serpent and turned back into the rod again, and the token of putting his hand into his bosom. It came out snowy white with leprosy. Putting it into the bosom again, it came out healed and well. And he said even greater signs than this would he do before Pharaoh, but he would harden Pharaoh's heart and he wouldn't let him go. Moses said, verse 13, Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel and shall say unto them, The God of your fathers has sent me unto you, and they say to me, What is his name? What shall I say unto them? And God said to Moses, I am that I am. The margin says, Eliyah, Asher, Eliyah, implying, I am the ever-living one. I am that which I am. I will be that which I will be. Jesus Christ was nearly murdered when he told the Jews before Abraham was, I am, thus using the very name of God that appeared to Moses there by that burning bush. And God said moreover to Moses, Thus you shall say unto the children of Israel, The eternal God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. I find it fascinating that the so-called sacred names people do not insist that we go around praying to I am. I also remember a set to with one of them many, many years ago at the Feast of Tabernacles in Big Sandy when my father was there, and this man was absolutely insisting upon using a certain name. And so my father simply turned to the Sermon on the Mount And he read to the man how Jesus said, "When you pray, say, 'Our Father, which art in heaven, will you, sir, do this?'" He said, "No, absolutely not." So that was the end of that discussion. It's amazing what some people will get locked into their heads about what gets them holier, what gets them closer to God. I know of a church organization that should right now, and I won't belabor this, but just say it in passing for you to ponder, be blessed above all church organizations that you've ever known of because they got rid of a person that they hate. So therefore, they should be a lot holier than they used to be, should they not? Absolutely purgated, absolutely washed clean. Therefore, where are the healings? Where are the miracles? Where is the growth? Where are the blessings? Just something to ponder in passing. If you will go to the book of Joshua, the 5th chapter, it's interesting that this happened again. If you read through the book of Joshua, by the way, Joshua's name in Hebrew, Yahshua, if the soft Y or J is preferred, is identical to Jesus in the Greek in the New Testament. So actually, when they spoke of Jesus, although never, believe it or not, in 3.5 years, did any one of the disciples ever address Jesus by his name, Jesus. They never called him that. In all 4 Gospels, there is not one time, one place, one account. Yet today, in organized Protestantism, churchianity, fundamentalism in this country, people just use that name over and over and over again. But you see, that wasn't his title. That was the name Yahshua, and Joshua in the Old Testament and Jesus in the New are identical. Joshua, because he led the children of Israel over the River Jordan, is a type of Jesus Christ coming to this earth and to conquer and to rule it with a rod of iron. Joshua attacking, first of all, Jericho, then Ai, then Og, the king of Bashan, then all of those various kings, many, many, many of them, going all the way north to the foothills of Mount Hermon and all the way south to the land of Goshen. And he and his armies slaughtered tens, if not hundreds, of thousands of people during his lifetime, if you study the book of Joshua. Because God had given him and the armies of Israel charge to utterly annihilate these rotten sun worshipers and these people who were instilling in the minds and hearts of their little boys and girls the incredible filth of that kind of paganism that resulted in infant sacrifice and resulted in every kind of evil you can imagine, not only the diseases that were extant, and I could comment on that for the next hour and probably get myself killed for talking about one particularly obnoxious disease that has come out of Africa because of some of the practices of some of those people. It wasn't hiding under a rock. It didn't jump out and hit somebody in Poughkeepsie or Peoria one day. It's a result of human filthiness and so on, but in any event, these people practiced the sacrifice of their own children in the most horrible fashion, literally burning them alive in order to give back a child to the gods that they worship. So a lot of people have trouble with that. And what really gives them trouble is when they find out that the Jesus Christ of the New Testament, according to John the 1st chapter and Hebrews the 1st chapter, which you can read with no one there to misinterpret it, is the one who is the God of the Old Testament, and the one who appeared here to Moses and who appeared unto Joshua and told Joshua to annihilate all those people. There are a lot of Protestants who have great trouble even imagining that Jesus Christ of Nazareth, would ever carry out the death penalty on anybody, because they can just imagine him as somebody who would not step on a crack or not kill a flea or an ant or not hurt a fly, as they say. And so they just can't deal with that. But look at Revelation 19. I won't turn to that. At Isaiah 11, with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. It says the first act he is going to perform is to grab the beast and the false prophet, who are mass murderers and will have been responsible for the death of literally millions of people, just like Stalin and Hitler, and throw them kicking and screaming into the lake of fire. No one deserves it more richly. Yet, if it were allowed of God, there would be people parading up and down between Christ and the precipice leading over into the valley of Hinnom, saying, "Let these poor people go. Don't descend to their level. Thou shalt not kill. It's unthinkable that we should carry out the death penalty." But Christ is going to do it, according to Revelation, the 19th chapter. Now, if you look at the analogies of the book of Joshua, and I would just say to you that sometime to have a real enjoyable Sabbath, you ought to just slowly read the whole book with that in mind, that Christ is not going to bring instant peace. The instant that his feet stand on the Mount of Olives, peace does not break out all over the earth. He is going to be resisted. He's going to be fought. It says in Zechariah 14 that he will send out an edict for people to come up and keep the Feast of Tabernacles, and many of them are going to rebel. And he's going to have to send plagues, and plagues such as drought result in malnutrition and starvation and in the breakout of disease. Plagues such as other types of plagues can result in the pollution of surface water and therefore a breakout of things like typhoid fever and so on. And it says that there are going to be plagues against people who will resist God's will and resist the new government of God when Christ stands on this earth. They resisted Joshua, and Joshua and his armies had to absolutely expunge the earth. City after city, they were told, don't spare a man, a woman, or a child. And they did it. Read that book. And it was through his entire lifetime that he had to expurgate, to expunge from the entire land of Palestine all those various people. And when they rebelled and didn't obey God perfectly, and they allowed some of them to live among them exactly as God said, that element, with its paganism, would eventually, like one rotten orange in the box, poison the whole society, and little by little, the Israelites began to give in to some of the paganism around them and to go the way of those foreign nations. Joshua 5:13-15, it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with a sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, are you for us or for our adversaries? Because this was in the case of where he was yet attacking another city. And he said, nay, but as captain of the host of the JHVH, or the YHVH it is in the original Hebrew, which has no vowels and only consonants. It's always translated in the King James Old Testament, capital letters, L-O-R-D. But it is the one that is referred to as Jehovah. And as Bullinger explains in a companion Bible, that is the eternal member of Elohim who enters into covenant relationship with Israel and who therefore is the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob, reiterating the covenant that he made with them and the promise of the eternal inheritance of the land. He said, nay, but as captain of the host of the eternal I am now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship and said unto him, what saith my Lord unto his servant? And the captain of the Lord's host said unto Joshua, loose your shoe from off your foot, for the place whereupon you stand is holy. And Joshua did so. Why was it holy? If you go on and read the ensuing verses, then God himself, the one that we know of as Jesus Christ, began to talk with Joshua. And it was holy because of that presence and because there was an archangel there. It hadn't been holy the day before, and it wasn't holy the moment after they left. It was holy because of the presence of God for that brief period of time. Now, believe it or not, where we are meeting right now today is a holy place. Do you know why? Because you are here, and because God's presence is here, and because the presence of Jesus Christ is here, and because, very likely, and I hope this is true, some of his angels are also here. And they don't need empty seats. They don't need those empty booths. They can be suspended in air, or they can be halfway through the wall, or they can be perched on the fronds of an artificial tree, because they are not constrained by the dimension in which we live whatsoever. You're all aware of the fact that there are religions extant in this country as well as in many other pagan nations, and I say that advisedly, where people actually think that a piece of wood is holy, or a chip of a rock is holy, or a piece of metal shaped in the form of a crucifix or a cross is holy. And they lay great store on that. You have all heard of the Shroud of Turin. And you have heard of weeping and bleeding statuary in one great universal religion. But probably unless you have traveled to Europe and seen some of the great basilicas and seen some of the sites that we have noticed down in, say, the, as they call it down there, La Basilica de la Virgen de Guadalupe, which is the patron saint of all of the Spanish-speaking people in Mexico City. And here are people who are crawling on their knees for 5 miles on rough cobblestones till they are bleeding and going up and petitioning this icon, this painting, which is really an artist's version of what you see in Revelation, the 12th chapter, the woman standing as if in the rays of the sun, and so on, and is called the Virgin of Guadalupe. Well, back in the back rooms of that basilica are many paintings on the walls of alleged appearances of this Virgin to people and their story about some great thing that occurred. You've all heard of Lourdes. You've heard of holy places that are visited by Roman Catholics as well as other people, and that they lay great store by that. Tell you a quick story. The man that later on became the Pope was ordaining a whole group of priests that had their heads shaved, a little bald spot in the middle of it that day when my wife and I and my mother and father and my brother Dick were at Il Duomo in Milano in Italy. Il Duomo merely in Italian means the dome. Well, it was quite a procession, but it was interesting because a very hot sunny day, and outside were the ramshackle little kiosks with all of the sacred objects for sale, so that visiting Catholics from all over the world could come in there and buy a crucifix or a bead, a rosary or whatever, and then hold it up and have this person make the funny signs and bless it. Well, my wife and my mother, it was a very hot, steamy, summery day, assayed to go. I'm trying to look to see what she's wearing. She's okay today. It's okay. She has long sleeves on today. But at that time, in that climate, both my wife and my mom had short sleeve traveling dresses on, or maybe a blouse and a skirt. And so we walked up to the huge door, and there were other people going and coming. We tried to go in, and this berobed priest came out. Oh, no, 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 I'm sorry, he said in his thick Italian accent. No, no, you can't enter. Can't enter like that. Oh, no, no. Women cannot go in, have to have the scarf, and can't go in with those short-sleeved blouses on. Because I guess from that part of your arm to here is the sexiest part of a woman's body, I guess. I don't know, but couldn't go in. So we had to go to one of those little kiosks, and my wife and my mom had to buy, did you buy a shawl or go back and get a sweater? A shawl, I think, and had to put it over their heads. But in the meantime, while they went to buy, my brother and I were standing there enjoying looking at all the pigeons and all the people when this prostitute sidled up to us and began to ask us if we were interested on the steps of the church while the priest stood there watching. I've always thought that that was strange, you know, that they allowed that to go on, but they wouldn't let my mom, who is one of the most Christian women I've ever known in my entire life, or my wife, same comment, enter into their church with short sleeve shirts or without a shawl on their head. But again, that was their idea of a holy place. If you'll go to Leviticus, the 23rd chapter, I want to ask you a question as you're turning there. Before God revealed when these annual holy days were to be observed, was that moment in time, extrapolating backwards 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years, or 1,000 years, holy? Was God merely telling them, now I made this time holy centuries ago, and it's about time you began to keep it? That isn't what he said. He proclaimed them right then and there. My dad used to put it this way. The Sabbath was made for man because the Sabbath was made when man was made. The annual Sabbaths were made for the church, and they were revealed or made and set aside by God when the church was made, the church in the wilderness. In this case, the analogy is Israel as a nation. Chapter 23, verse 1, the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them concerning the festivals, that is the feasts of the Eternal, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, even these are my feasts, not Jewish feasts, but my feasts. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of rest and holy convocation, a commanded assembly. You shall do no work therein. It is the Sabbath of the Eternal in all your dwellings. How do you know when the Sabbath comes? Well, you look at a calendar. But go study the article in any major encyclopedia about calendar, and find out about the solar calendar that we observe today that is actually a relic from Gregorian times. There was the Julian calendar before that, and before that, of course, there was only the Hebrew calendar. And then, of course, when the Arabs began with the Hegira, they actually began with the very first year in the Arab calendar with the famous Hajj of Muhammad. So a lot of people count time differently. The Sabbath is not observable by any astronomical phenomena. It is absolutely unknown except that a race of people, for all of these generations in all of these centuries from time immemorial have kept track of what time it was. And a whole nation doesn't lose track of what day it is, even though some of us might lose track of a day or two now and then, say, what day is this, or what date is it on the calendar, or is this Thursday? I thought it was Tuesday, or whatever. But your wife will straighten you out, or someone else will. You will certainly not have hundreds of thousands or millions of people lose track of what day it is all at once. So the Sabbath is made as a holy period of time. And it's interesting, in the 56th chapter of Isaiah, I won't turn to that, when God shows his blessings for observance of the Sabbath, it talks about those who would keep their foot from his Sabbath day. So the analogy is, as Moses and as Joshua were told to take their shoes off because they couldn't track the dust and the dirt of their lives as well as the trails that they had trod into that area, and it was merely a symbol that they were to acknowledge that that was a holy place because of the holy presence of who was there. That in like fashion, the analogy is given that those who would keep their foot off of God's Sabbath day would be blessed. These are the feasts of the Jews. Verse 4. Now, I did that deliberately, didn't I? It says the feasts of the Lord, the feasts of God, the eternal, even holy convocations, which you shall proclaim in their seasons. Now, I want to emphasize Pentecost because many of the brethren in smaller churches and in fellowship groups and many individuals are going to be playing a tape on the day of Pentecost, and I would like to give them one a little ahead of time as well to consider this. If you will now go to the 10th verse of this chapter, I want you to notice some language you may not have noticed in the past when you've read it. Speak unto the children of Israel and say unto them, when ye be come into the land which I give unto you, and shall reap the harvest thereof, then, when you come into the land, and when you've harvested the grain for the first time, then shall you bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest unto the priest. Question. Since these were observed, and these were actually delivered to the foot of Mount Sinai, and the Passover was observed in the pre-exilic Passover of the flight out of Egypt, was the Feast of Pentecost observed ever in the land of Sinai? Answer, no, not once. It was revealed there, but it's revealed as an event that they should celebrate once they were able to bring in a harvest. They were not harvesters. They were not agrarian. They were nomadic cattle and sheep herders during all of those 40 years in the wilderness. They were not growing crops. They didn't stay in any one place long enough to do that, but they did inherit the land of milk and honey, and they went in and planted crops once they got into the land, and then they began to harvest. If you look at Joshua 5, I won't do that. It said that when they first went in and Jericho fell and then they defeated Ai and some of the other kings, it said they ate of the old store of the land, parched corn and so on, because they had not grown any new grain at that time. They had to eat some of the stored grain that was there in the grain houses of the people that they overthrew. So he said, when you come into the land, you shall wave the sheaf before the eternal. Now the wave sheaf was barley, because the barley ripened far earlier than wheat. Wheat ripened a little bit later on, a few weeks later. You shall wave the sheaf before the eternal be accepted for you. On the morrow, after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. There's been great controversy, as Kiddo's Bible Cyclopedia says, the Encyclopedia Biblica has an article on it. Hastings Bible Dictionary has an article on it. I read this morning. Kiddo's does, I mentioned that. The Companion Bible. Actually, the Pharisees during Jesus' time observed it one day differently than did the Sadducees, but the Sadducees were doing it correctly, and they had charge of the temple. And they counted from the weekly Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread, where the Pharisees tried to insist that it was the annual holy day, the first day of unleavened bread, and count from that time. You shall offer that day when you wave the sheaf and he lamb without blemish. I won't read all of that, the meat offerings and drink offerings and so on, although it is interesting in one sense, because there were to be loaves that were offered later on at the time of Pentecost, and we'll notice that a little later. It should be a statute forever in your generations and all of your dwellings, verse 14. Verse 15, you shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheep of the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be complete. You would think that is the simplest statement you've ever read in your life. But the expression mimo horat, that has to do with the terminus ad quem, and has to do with where you begin counting and the place to which you arrive when you have finished counting, became a subject of tremendous controversy in the church for decades. Now, let me go back and give you a little bit of church history right quickly to help your understanding of holy times and holy places. Just the other day, I sent Mr. George Trent a little email because I looked ahead and found out that I believe it's the Saturday night of the May 5th. May 5th would be the second Passover. And you know that there was the allowance for those who had been defiled by a dead body or a dead relative or some other defilement that they could not observe the Passover at the time it was observed on the 14th of Nisan. So God provided that they could do it in an alternative or an alternate month, 1 month later. You also know about the great restoration of Josiah, how they couldn't cleanse the temple and the priests in time, so they kept the days of unleavened bread, not just the Passover, but all 7 days of unleavened bread, 1 month late, and then they kept yet another 7 days, completely unauthorized. They did it themselves, and it said their prayer was heard and ascended up to heaven, and that God blessed them in that. God smiled from heaven. He approved of it, but there was nothing at all holy about the time in which they did it. The time itself was not holy. It's interesting that back during my boyhood, a woman came to my father and said that an angel had told her, Pentecost is on a Monday. So my father began to study. He looked at this verse here. He looked into the meaning of the Hebrew word from. The Hebrew word from means the same thing it does in English. If I meet you here, now listen to this argument, one day from today, when are we going to meet? Tomorrow, right? Well, that's one day out of today. It's not today. It's not one day in today. It's not beginning with today. It's beginning a way out of today, one day. If I meet you here 1 week from today, when are we going to meet? Next Sabbath, and I hope that I do. But if I start counting today, that's 8 days, isn't it? Sabbath to Sabbath inclusive, 8 days. Sabbath to Sabbath exclusive, 7 days. You begin counting a way out of. When you count time, 1 year from this day today, you don't include the day you're starting to count mostly, but there are many ways in which you count inclusively. What is a way you can think of? How about from wall to wall? How about from head to toe? A lot of ways in which the word is used inclusively. But when you're also given the clue as to exactly what day you are to arrive at, and the only reason you're counting is because the first festival you're talking about is celebrated based upon the vernal equinox. And a vernal equinox is the first day of spring. And that was the spring barley harvest, and they could only begin to celebrate the month when they observed by the little sliver of the new moon in that springtime which month was Abib. And believe it or not, it would change over the decades, because sometimes, dependent upon weather, spring was late that year, and there weren't any green ears yet. And so it was the next month that became Abib. Tel Aviv in Israel is Tel Aviv, or Abib, and it is named after the fact that that's the first month on the Jewish calendar. So when he chose the weekly Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread, and he said, you shall count unto you, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete, unto the morrow after the seventh Sabbath. It's always got to be the first day of the week. God never dignified any of the days of the week with a name except one. The others just had numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They weren't called the day of the moon. They weren't called the day of Zeus. They weren't called the day of Woden or the day of Thor or the day of Freya or the day of Saturn or the day of the sun. But they were called Shabbat, Sabbath, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And so God told them exactly how to count and why they were to count, because this was a harvest festival. And as I've shown in the booklet that now I guess they're sending out, and they are really making those booklets holy because they are expunging from them the obnoxious name of the author, so that when people write in for the book Europe and America in Prophecy or The Answer to Unanswered Prayer, they just get a big black rubber stamp or a white piece of tape or something over my name so nobody will know that I wrote the book. Well, I wrote the book. That's okay. I wrote the book. God knows it. I know it. Most of the people who read it know it. So there's no problem there. Now, the harvest of this earth that God depicts in prophecy. I'm going to turn to that real quickly and then turn back to this. In the book of Revelation chapter 14, there is metaphor used. And again, it is like a man in a field with a sickle. It is, in this case, both a very good harvest and a very bad harvest. Verse 12, here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God. What's that doing in the Bible written by John at 92 A.D.? 61 years after the ascension of Christ, John writes, those that keep the commandments of God. What law is there in the Bible you know of called the commandments of God except the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, revealed in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, and the faith of Jesus? And I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. One of the most hated words in all of Protestantism and Catholicism, the word works. The idea that there is anything you must do other than just ideas in your mind just makes them fighting mad. Yet all through the Word of God, it talks about you are known by your works, by their fruits shall they be known, as Christ said. They're going to be judged according to their works. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man. Obviously, people, beings, don't sit on clouds unless they are a spirit being. And this, again, is metaphor, a spiritual metaphor. It's what he saw. Having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat in the cloud, thrust in your sickle and reap. So this is just like an old scythe or a sickle. When I was a little boy, I used to actually cut the yard with a hand sickle. We didn't own a lawnmower back then. Pretty rough-looking job, too, I'll tell you. Thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time has come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. Interesting language. He that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. And that is what? The dead in Christ. Blessed are the dead that die in the Lord from henceforth, that they may rest in their labors, and their works do follow them. And that is the first harvest. That is the first fruits from the dead. And the feast of the first fruits, the first harvest, the barley harvest in Palestine, was a picture of that part of God's plan. That explains why it is that there are so very few that know the real truth of God, are willing to accept it, are willing to be converted and baptized today. That it's like a strange, weird, cultic, foreign, almost pagan religion to them. They don't understand it. There are many, many people who have had their eyes open when other members of their family have not, and have been mercilessly persecuted as a result. Divorces have resulted. People have lost their jobs. Children have separated. Parents have separated. Churches have split because of people discovering the truth of God and beginning to believe it. It is very, very rare. Another angel came out of the altar, which had the power over fire, and cried with a loud voice to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine and of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. This is where the term grapes of wrath comes from. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. Joel 3:3 tells you about that, as does the 19th chapter of Revelation. That is a very horrible verse about blood up to the horses' bridles by the space of 1,600 furlongs, and a furlong is about 1/9 of 1 mile. So that's a tremendous amount of bloodshed in the Middle East at the time of the Battle of Armageddon. Back to the 23rd chapter of the book of Leviticus. You shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, verse 15, from the day that you brought the sheep of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. Years ago, they wanted to make that mean weeks. And some people began to call it the Feast of Weeks, and erroneously, some of the biblical translators have taken the word sabbaton. You hear that as a B-B-A-T-O-N, meaning more than one Sabbath, which is merely the plural, and translated it weeks, which is erroneous. Let me tell you why. What is a week? Class, write it down. You know what a week is? Well, a week is a divine unit of time. A week never has been Tuesday to Tuesday. That is not the meaning of the term, because the word in the English language was invented centuries and centuries later in the pagan tongue that I am using today. The word sounds kind of weird. You can take any word in the English language and say it over and over and over and over and over again, can't you? And pretty soon it loses all sense and all meaning. Weak, 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 weak sounds like a chirping bird. Sounds like a night creature of some kind. We pronounce W-E-A-K the same way. But a week is a Sabbath to a Sabbath, a divine unit of time that began at creation. And again, a week, the weekly cycle, is not observable by any astrological or astronomical, better said, phenomenon. Now, what unit of time is measurable by astronomical phenomena? The day. Because the sun rises, we say, it doesn't really, the earth rolls away from it. Or the sun sets. No, it doesn't, but the earth rolls away from the sun. Every day. With a sundial, you can actually look at the shadow. A lot of people like to have them in their yards, and they're just awfully accurate, by the way. The most accurate timepiece you can buy is a sundial when the sun is shining. So a day is observable. What about the month? Yeah. What about the quarter moons? Yeah, that's pretty much observable, but it's hard to tell within a 2 or 3 day period, and it's also hard to tell exactly when the new moon is in every occasion, which is why they had to have a number of priests and had to observe it, and sometimes it wasn't exactly precise and could be a day or so off. To give you the example of the stupid Muslim calendar that they began based upon the Hegira, they decided they ought to divide the year into 12 equal months of 29 days and 30 days, alternating them. But in the course of about a century, they got 3 days missing. If you study the article calendar, you will find out you have gone into something that will just boggle your mind. When you try to harmonize the movements of the earth and the moon around the earth as it takes its yearly journey around the sun. And understand, we have a sole lunar calendar, both based upon the yearly journey of the earth around the sun and the monthly journey of the moon around the earth. You are looking at time measured in terms of distance or space, aren't you? So time and space are the same thing in one sense. You're looking at time measured by astronomical phenomena. And here he says, seven Sabbaths shall be complete. It should not be called the Feast of Weeks because it can lead to deception. Now, because my father, very correctly, in his own mind, with great sincerity, because he always had what that lady said to him in the back of his mind, and he had reason to believe that an angel had spoken to the lady. So when he saw this, and he began to say, now wait, if you count from the morrow after the Sabbath, you count beginning with the day after that morrow, which is a Monday. And so you arrive at a Monday. And for decades, based upon that conception, the Radio Church of God, later the Worldwide Church of God, observed Pentecost on a Monday. Now, to those who believe in holy places and holy times, let me go back and give you a little quick vignette of church history. The greatest decade in the history of that church, when we were growing almost straight across the board in every department, festival attendance, new baptisms, income, department by department, at the rate of the phenomenal rate of 30% per year. Think of that. 30% per year from 1958 to 1968 when my mother died. We maintained that kind of an incredible growth. Every time we would come up with a new feast site, it would be outgrown on the first year we moved in. The colleges were growing. New colleges were developing. Thousands were being baptized. Dozens of churches were being raised up. The young students, seniors, and juniors would take baptismal tours all over the United States and other countries around the world. We opened up about 19 foreign offices. We started 3 college campuses. The income grew to $100 million, $120 million, $135 million, on up toward $200 million a year. The church finally had over 150,000 members. We had about 19 to 21 foreign offices. The Plain Truth magazine was published in German, in Italian, in French, in Spanish, and there may have been one other. My programs were heard all over Europe, into Russia. They were translated in Russian. They were done by an Italian. They were done by a Spaniard or a Mexican. They were done in French by D. Bar Aparkian. They were done by a German in the German language. We had a magazine called Die kleine Wahrheit, which is the plain truth in German. We had La pura verdad, which is the plain truth in Spanish. We had La pure vérité, which is the pure truth or the plain truth in French. That church was booming upward, and all that decade we kept Pentecost on the wrong day. Now, does that say anything? I mean, I'm a pragmatist in one sense, and that's, you know, what works or what is, and you have to agree with reality. To me, that says that even though my father was wrong, and we were keeping Pentecost on a Monday, which is not the correct date, Sunday is, God blessed that church because the heart was right and the intent was right. And there was no intent to deceive. And furthermore, what is interesting is that during all that period of time, we really had three festivals, which is exactly what God said when he talked about the three major feasts of the year that are seasonal. That would be the spring festival and then Pentecost, well, the days of unleavened bread, then Pentecost, then tabernacles are the three that are mentioned that the three men, the men of Israel should attend. Those three times are three seasons in the year. And we would have an eight-day festival up at Big Sandy for the Days of Unleavened Bread, and we would have daily meetings. We would have at least two sermons per day and two sermonettes and all of that. And then we would have Pentecost, and it would always be Pentecost weekend. We would come for the weekly Sabbath. Then we'd have preaching services on that Sunday, and then we'd stay over and have preaching services on Monday, which we thought was Pentecost. So without us even knowing it, we were meeting together as God's church on that Sunday, which really was Pentecost, and observing it just as an incidental day in between the weekly Sabbath and Pentecost anyway. And God blessed the church enormously during all of that time. The way we count, of course, is obvious from this verse. You count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, which is a Sunday, from the day that you brought the sheep of the wave offering, which was a Sabbath, so you begin on the following day. Now, you see, if you just read that part of the verse, not focus on a word from the morrow, then you take my father's analogy and you're correct. If you count, forget the words here for a moment, from the morrow after the Sabbath. He's repeating it redundantly, doing it twice. And just say it says here, you shall count from the day that you brought the sheep of the wave offering. And what my dad said is right, a way out of the next day, beginning with that day, Sunday, 1. Tuesday, 2, Wednesday, 3, etc., till you get to the following Sabbath. 7 Sabbaths shall be complete, even on the morrow after the 7th Sabbath, and you're always going to end up on what we call a Sunday, shall you number 50 days. And the word Pentecost is a Greek word which never occurs in the Old Testament. No Israelite ever heard that word come out of anybody's mouth until they began to learn Greek in the Hellenistic days of the Second Temple and during Jesus' day. So, we know that the day that is called Pentecost should be observed on a Sunday. There were other biases that resulted in that doctrine, by the way. There was an anti-Sunday bias, anything having to do with Sunday. But if you look in the Bible very carefully and you realize that Christ was crucified on a Wednesday afternoon and that he was resurrected on a late Sabbath afternoon, that he told Mary and the other women when he appeared to them on the road to Emmaus, don't touch me, don't hang on to me, don't touch me, I've not yet ascended to my Father, but I ascend to my Father, you go and tell my brethren, and I will come and see them. So that very same night, he entered through a wall where the doors were shut and allowed Thomas to not only touch him, but to put his hand inside the wound in his side and to handle his wrist where the great spikes had ripped the holes in his flesh. So we know that Christ ascended to heaven and was received of his Father on what we call a Sunday, following that Sabbath afternoon resurrection. There was no real reason then for them to avoid having the day of Pentecost occur on a Sunday, which in fact it does. Now let's turn to the first chapter of the book of Acts right quickly in the few minutes I have left. We'll go through a great deal more of this on the day of Pentecost, of course. They were told to wait. Verse 3, he had shown himself alive after his passion by many infallible proofs. Remember that these were unwilling witnesses. They didn't want to believe it. Most of them had forsaken him, and they said, as Doubting Thomas said, I will never believe it until I see the wounds in his hand and his side. And that's exactly what Christ showed him to convict him. They were unwilling witnesses. They didn't want to believe it. They thought it was all over. They thought that's the end of a good thing. He's not going to restore the kingdom now. It's all over. Let's get out of here. Peter said, I'm going back fishing, remember? Let's go back to our jobs and our homes. Being seen of them 40 days. 40 is always a number used for a time of trial or testing. 40 years, 40 days. And this was a test. It was absolute proof after they had seen him time and time again for 40 days and speaking of the things pertaining to the kingdom of God. And being assembled together with them, commanded them that they should not depart from Jerusalem, but wait. Now why? Why wait? They were to wait for the promise from on high, which he said, you have heard of me. For John truly baptized with water, but you shall be baptized with the Holy Spirit not many days hence. Why not then? Why not while he was with them during those 40 days? Because the day of the 50th day, and that's all the word Pentecost means. These people running around, oh, I'm a member of the 50th church. You know, I believe in all the events of the 50th. If they just knew, if they weren't, you know, they even misspelled it in one street in Fort Worth. It's Pentecost on the street signs over there. Pentecost Street. Bugs me. Anyway, it's Pentecost, and it merely means the 50th because they counted seven Sabbaths and arrived at the 50th day. But it really is the Feast of the First Fruits. It's the Feast of the First Harvest. And the fact that at Pentecost, or at the Feast of the First Fruits, they waved two loaves said something very significant. They waved on the first Sabbath, the morrow after the Sabbath of the Days of Unleavened Bread, a sheaf. That said, the barley is in the ear, the grain is in the field. We thank God for the rain and the sun and the soil. We thank God for the barley harvest. The spiritual type was lost totally on Israel during that day. And here is an armload of it in the priest's arms to wave it in thanksgiving before God. 50 days later, the wheat had ripened, and they're bringing in the other grains. Now they are waving two loaves, and the loaves symbolize we have harvested that grain, we have ground the grain into flour, we have baked it in the ovens, and now here is our sustenance put in storehouses for the rest of this year. And the two wave loaves were waved before God in thanksgiving for that spring harvest. There were two harvests in Palestine. And he said, they asked him, will you now restore the kingdom to Israel? They didn't say the kingdom over all the earth. They said the kingdom, the greater Solomonic kingdom, the kingdom with you right here on the throne to Israel. And he said, it's not for you to know the times or the seasons which the Father has put in his own power, but you shall receive power. After that, the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you shall be witnesses unto me, both in Jerusalem and in all Judea, in Samaria, and unto the uttermost parts of the earth. And he was taken up. The angel said in verse 11, why do you stand gazing up into heaven? The same Jesus, which is taken up from you into heaven, shall so come in like manner as you have seen him go into heaven. That's going to be the biggest shock in the history of all of mankind when that occurs, because there are many millions of people who profess his name who just don't believe it. Years ago, there was a statistic that I came across that 44% of those in seminaries studying to be pastors in pulpits in this country don't believe in the literal second coming of Jesus Christ. But they stand up there and talk about Christian living and faith, hope, and charity. Chapter 2 and verse 1, and when the day of the 50th day, what is its real name in the Old Testament? Feast of First Fruits. The Feast of the First Fruits. It was the 50th day after the wave sheaf offering, but it's the Feast of the First Fruits. When the day of Pentecost, notice the emphasis by Luke, who wrote this, was fully come. Now, this was the daylight part. It had come at the sunset before. It's on an annual holy day. They were all with one accord in one place. Logically, they would have been, because they were Christ's disciples, and they were following his example. And suddenly, there came a sound from heaven as of a rushing mighty wind, and it filled all the house where they were sitting. And there appeared unto them, and this is a very unfortunate translation, as all the Bible helps and the commentaries and all of them point out. It should actually read, equally distributed licking flames of fire. You use the term a tongue of fire, and that's all it is meant by this, the idea of gibberish and a lot of gobbledygook and garbled tongue bitings and suspected Spanish epithets. By people who are carried away in some kind of a charismatic thrill of some sort, is utter nonsense. There appeared unto them, equally divided or distributed among them, like flickering flames of fire, and it sat upon each of them, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit, and began to speak with other languages as the Spirit gave them utterance. My tongue is in my mouth, but the tongue that I speak, and that's used commonly in all the languages, is the English tongue or the English language. The instrument of speech is used for the language in most languages, as a matter of fact. Lengua. You hear a francolingua? Comes from the Latin lengua. Where do you hear that? Language. Lengua is the instrument of speech in Latin or Spanish, and lengua is also language in Spanish. So they heard what? The wonderful works of God, and you see that in verses 8 through 13, where there were people from all over the Eastern world that were hearing the wonderful works of God at that time. Holy times, holy places, turn real quickly, I only have 1 minute, to the book of Revelation, chapter 11, and you will see what God says about the so-called holy city. Here are the two witnesses, and it says, their dead bodies, verse 8, shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. Can you get to be holy by going to Jerusalem today? When your Bible calls it Sodom and Egypt, and when you go there and you see the hatred and you see the filth and you see the avarice and the greed and the potential of being annihilated because of all the bombs exploding in cafes and buses and so on, you see that that is one of the filthiest cities on the face of the earth, not only from a religious standpoint, but just from the standpoint of the people that live there. There is nothing holy at all about the city of Jerusalem today, but it will be holy if and when God places His presence in it, and only then. A holy place is holy because God's people are there or because God is there present Himself. The minute we all get up and out of here, this is just going to be another old restaurant.